Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast number 5, Masculinity and Fatherhood, a conversation with Dr. David Kuhl. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. In this episode, we explore the role of men and boys in a positive way forward. It is so often said that men and patriarchy have a significant role in the creation and the persistence of most crucial problems humanity now face. Men and boys are falling behind across the globe, with higher rates of death by suicide and addiction, increased homelessness, and decreased life expectancy. In this far-reaching podcast, we explore what is happening with men and boys while having an important conversation about how men can become an even greater force for good in the way forward. Our guest, Dr. David Kuhl, is a physician, author, and co-founder of an NGO based at the University of British Columbia called Blueprint. After decades of practicing medicine, including time as a pioneer in the end-of-life care, Dr. Kuhl put down his stethoscope to dedicate himself to enhance the integrity and well-being of men and boys for the benefit of families and communities. He is author of What Dying People Want and has been a guest on The Oprah Show. He is doing leading-edge research on the positive impact of fathers. And now, I would like to introduce the hosts of A Way Forward Regenerative Conversations, Dr. John Izzo and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izzo, and on behalf of my co-host Alain Gauthier and our producer Jim Burke, I want to welcome you to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we explore through dialogue and conversation the way forward for humanity and planet. We don't have the answer about what the way forward is, but together we hope to explore the question so that together we can find out and explore how we might build a positive future. Now, today we're going to be talking about men and boys and why work is needed with men and boys to have a positive way forward. And I couldn't help but think along as I was preparing for our podcast today, just about some things that have happened just in the very recent days. Several more mass shootings, and Jim, our producer, found a statistic that in the United States alone this year, over 600 mass shootings. Some of them were likely gang violence, not necessarily our traditional thinking of what a mass shooting is. And 98% of those mass shootings around the globe have historically been perpetrated by men. I think about the war in Ukraine. And who started that war? Guess what? Men. Even though there are female soldiers now, the vast majority of those who are dying because of men starting that war will also be men. And of course, then lots of casualties of all genders. And I was thinking about Jane Goodall's research, who was really obsessed with the question as she was working with chimpanzees about whether they had a good or a bad nature, a generous or a violent and destructive nature. And she wanted so much, she said, to believe that chimpanzees had mostly a good, loving, generous nature. But what she concluded after years of up close research with the chimpanzees is that both were true. Both violence and generosity and goodness were in large measure in our nearest cousins. But she said almost all of the violence and the bad things, so to speak, were done by adolescent males among chimpanzees. So, Alain, I think a very important conversation as we think about the way forward.
Yes, it is. And I was just reading a quote by Malidoma Soma, who is an indigenous spiritual leader, saying that society that lacks rites of passage for young men is practically inviting anger and violence. So, yes, that's an important topic for us.
So I can't think of another person I would want to be in this conversation today than my friend of 20 years, who I share something with, in that we're both co-founders of an organization called Blueprint at the University of British Columbia. I'll let David say more about that. And David, first of all, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's great to join you. I look forward to our conversation.
So, David, we'll get into some of the things that we were talking about a moment ago, but you know, you have a fascinating history. You were a family physician for many years, a tenured professor at the School of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. You were an end-of-life physician. In fact, I'll toot your own horn, really was a leader in the movement around end-of-life and what is called by many palliative care. But tell us a little bit about what led you to, if you will, put down your stethoscope to do this work that you're now doing with men.
Thanks, John. I think that the seeds for this work were planted even in my childhood, in that my father was bipolar. So I understood the suffering and the anguish of the soul of a man who suffered almost on a daily basis and for much of his life. That's likely why I chose to go into medicine. And I learned from the men that I saw much more rarely than their wives and their sisters, men would resist coming to ask for help. And especially if it was issues around emotional, psychological, or mental challenges they were having. I chose to work in palliative care, and the organization St. Paul's Hospital was one of the first in the country to provide care for men with HIV and AIDS, as well as with those that had cancer. And I saw how many of the mothers came to the bedside of their sons, but very rarely was the father present. And that was very intriguing to me. And there's stories about that that actually compelled me to look more closely at what are the issues around father-son relationships. And because I chose to go back to school, I was then invited to develop a program for men in the military and transition from military to civilian life. And again, I saw the suffering these men had experienced even before they joined the military. And again, as they were coming back into the into civilian world, many of them were lost. And I just realized in observing all of this that there were so many men that were hurting, men that could express anger but couldn't shed a tear for sadness. And I began to see also that when they were given opportunity to speak about issues that were issues of the soul, healing began. So all of those events and opportunities actually led me to decide that I could probably be more beneficial to caring for people by focusing on the psychological and spiritual issues of men, particularly, very specifically, as opposed to being a family physician.
I'm curious, David, in that early work that you did with soldiers coming back from war who were not exclusively men, but the vast majority were men. You hinted at it a little bit, but what did you learn from that experience that might be really important for us to think about even in any conversation about men and boys? Is there anything that stands out that you learned from that experience that somehow seemed to be the heart of the matter, for lack of a better way to put it?
Yes, I think what I learned from them, many of them joined the military to be tough, to be strong, to protect their country. I mean, they volunteered to protect their country. I haven't done that. So they were very strong and adamant that being a man means you stand up for your country, you stand up for what is right. And at the same time, I could see and witness their resistance to talking about the pain they were having because of their experience and because of the effect it had had on them. And they then turned on themselves about saying, I'm not a good enough man, even though I went to protect the country and I did all of that. I can't admit to the fact that it was affected my soul. And some of them would actually eventually acknowledge that it was even soul destroying, that it just, we're not meant to be shooting people. We're not meant to be killing people. And while they went realizing that might be what they needed to do, they hadn't paused to ask what effect it might have on them. So it was that tension between the tender part of themselves that was suffering greatly in contrast to the being the real man they had been in volunteering and then going to some pretty tough places in the world.
Yeah, I was thinking but my mind's firing already in lots of directions. So I'll say the first thing that came to my mind, and I think really an interesting thing to explore, I go back to Jane Goodall's research with chimpanzees, and probably almost no one listening would disagree that the vast majority of violence, and certainly violence, there probably are many other ways in which men and women do equal immoral activities, however we define morality. But certainly when it comes to violence, as a prime example, we know men are more likely to be violent. But often people take the leap then that there's something fundamentally flawed about men and boys. And I know you're familiar with the research that shows that pre-puberty, that boys and girls have about the same number of intimate friendships, about the same ratio of nurturing behavior. But then something happens to boys as they approach and go into puberty. Talk a little bit about how you see this issue of, like, you know, because some would say, well, look, men are flawed. It's like, it was like a bad design. God or evolution made a mistake. You know, men just don't have whatever it takes for goodness and nurturing. But the research doesn't support that. But it, back to Alon's comment about rites of passage, it does support that something happens to men at a young age. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about that.
Thanks, John. And I would be so bold as to say that if you go into the younger years under 4 to 6, that boys may actually be equally or more emotionally expressive than girls. There's emerging data in all of these facets. So one needs to ask what has happened. And I think that at risk of being somewhat defensive, in terms of evolution, perhaps at some point there was a need for men to be very protective and to be guarding women and children as they were in community, and so that was an essential part of the survival of the species, is that somebody had to go out there and protect and provide. I think we've been slow to change and to share those responsibilities across genders. So I my sense is that the messages that we give our sons, and mostly those messages come from fathers, but not entirely. There are mothers that give the same message, so nobody is sort of off the hook on what are we doing. But we treat our sons and our daughters differently. When our son scrapes his knee, falls and scrapes his knee, we say, come on, be tough, don't cry, be a man. We give them very strong messages, and perhaps we take our daughters and say, oh, isn't that unfortunate, you hurt your knee. That's a very different response. One is very empathic and the other one is not so empathic. And so we give our sons messages about what it means to be a man: be strong, be independent, don't ask for help. Features of success have to do with power and authority, whether it's financial or physical, so that by the time they get into adolescence, where they're actually supposed to become men, they take those messages to heart. And those messages start when boys are 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. So and we know in terms of the way the mind works that memory is a very powerful feature of what we grow up to.
I read that the mission of Blueprint is to improve the integrity and well-being of men and boys for the benefit of families and communities. So can you say a little more about you just mentioned the role of the community. I also am aware that men mostly work, learn through rituals, some forms of rituals that enable them to embody something inside them. So can you say more about this?
I really like your comment about rituals and symbols. Men respond very well to rituals. And often when I see men on a one-to-one and they're having trouble letting something go, I remember I read about one man who was full of grief because of the death of his partner, and he didn't know how to express it. But he was a man of nature. So what he did is he went to the woods where he spent his most meaningful, soulful time. And he carved a rectangle in a tree and took the bark off of that rectangle. And so one of his favorite trees was also wounded, but only slightly. And he went back to that tree every day. And once the bark had been replaced and grown so that you could still see that there were some edges to it, but mostly the bark had been restored, he realized his grief was now less. So I think that it's all of the our safety and expression of the emotion. And can we do that in our families? And can we do it in our communities? Are all of those places safe enough for us to begin to explore other emotions? It's something else I say in terms of evolution. If all of our emotions didn't serve a purpose, evolution would have gotten rid of them long ago. So ironically, it seems that we're most comfortable with anger. And I think that for men, that there's two features. One is sexual excitement and the other one is anger. Those are the ones we get credit for being real men. And we need to look at some of the other emotions that we may also need. And that's why I like the word for the integrity and well-being. My perspective of integrity is that we express all of the emotions we have because they all serve a purpose. I'm not sure whether that answered your question or not, or I'd be interested in your response to what I just said.
Well, it's indeed interesting. The word ritual is understood differently by people. It's not just religious ritual.
That's right.
And I assume, in fact, there are some rituals, but they can be some negative rituals within gangs, for instance.
That's right.
Where do we come to the positive rituals that we either follow by ourselves or in others make us value other forms of emotions that we can work from in our lives?
That's right. And in our work, we realize it's often invitation or giving men permission to be more than what they are or more than what they may have learned. Right. Mm. So that in terms of when we work with firefighters, for example, and if they begin to speak of experiences where they were incredibly isolated and suffered badly or experienced sexual abuse, we actually, with their permission, then will ask the other firefighters present to put their hands on the person's back just so they have the experience of the presence of another as they speak about the depth of their despair and their suffering. So, and then we get them to say, push hard. So this person is really aware of your presence. That's a very significant and effective ritual that they then take a body memory with them, which is our whole goal, is to give men another way of expressing and experiencing emotion and also experiencing the company of other men and women. Mostly in those domains, it is primarily male.
So, David, we'll kind of dig back into a lot of these. I feel like a mosquito in a nudist colony. There's so many places we can go right now. But I think for the sake of our listeners, just tell us a little bit about Blueprint. What is Blueprint? What does it do? And you've hinted at some of the work, for example, with firefighters. But give us a flyby about Blueprint.
You know, I've given that some thought in terms of what would I say today. Partly, I want to say something I haven't sort of said before. I think Blueprint is an invitation for men to change their behavior, men to change the focus of who they are in the relationship to themselves, to each other, to their partners, and to their children. And so that we've chosen an academic foundation to say that the work we do and the programs we develop must be have some rigor to them in terms of evaluation, in terms of assessment with regard to outcome, because we do want to be academically credible and legitimate. So that is a primary value. But our bigger value has to do with collaboration. And to be working with each other in a respectful way, to be working with other organizations in a respectful way, and to invite, as I say, invite men to live by a different blueprint. And we don't presume to have a blueprint. Our goal is to create many blueprints for change, because there need to be many, whether it's a 7-year-old boy, a 13-year-old boy, or a 40-year-old man. They may need different blueprints, but we need to change. And it's men are contributing to the destruction of the globe much more than women. And so it behooves us then also to be the change agents for the positive.
And what is the role of compassion in the work that you do? To develop compassion for oneself, possibly for others, is that a factor that you feel is a key one in the work you do?
I really like that you use the word compassion. We teach a lot of empathy, which has to do with understanding the experienced behavior of another person. Compassion is to see the suffering of another and to take action to alleviate it. And so our goal is to be compassionate toward ourselves, because we're no different from the rest of the men in the world. We also have a need to change. We have a need to be different in our relationships. We need to look for diversity and inclusion. We need to be aware that the three of us who are the founders are, quote, old white guys. So we hold privilege that we might not even see. John often talks about that people of privilege don't see it, and we're at risk of that. So that our goal is, yes, for men to be compassionate enough toward themselves, to begin to ask for help, for an example, to be compassionate in terms of their wives and what can I do to contribute to a different home life, to so that we're equal in all of those things. And that's also true for children and other men and other members of our community. And another thing John is really good at is, how can we be compassionate to the globe? How can we be compassionate to the environment, to the climate? How can we begin to ask for permission rather than just extracting from the globe? So that's the goal. And the biggest feature is to, yes, be compassionate toward ourselves, which hopefully will allow us to be more compassionate toward others and ultimately communities and the globe as well.
You know, one of the things that this kind of brings up for me, thank you, David and Alan, is really something you might be asking, well, why do we need to do work with men and boys? Haven't we focused on men and boys for thousands of years? And I think of an experience I had when I was a delegate to the UN Conference on Population and Development in Cairo in 1994. And the meta question of the conference was, how can we reduce population growth and create sustainable economic development for people across the globe, especially in the developing world? And by the end of the conference, one major theme emerged. We must help women and especially young girls. If we help them get an education, we help them have more economic opportunities, they will have fewer children, they will have more freedom, the societies will develop economically and socially. And we all doubled down. I was in on that, the need to help women and girls across the globe. And I think it was the right decision, and we're not there yet, but we've made incredible progress in the, you know, almost 30 years since. What's interesting to me is I don't remember one person at the conference saying, maybe we also got to do something about men and boys if we're going to create a sustainable future. And you hear all these stories now in the developing world, women unable to find a spouse because the development of the girls and the women has gone so much further than the emotional, psychological development of the boys. My friend Sean Askenosi, who does sustainable coffee out of Tanzania, he said, we got to have a curriculum in school for boys. And when he went to the UN 10 years ago and suggested it, they said, well, we don't know anyone who's done that. And what's more, we don't see the need for a curriculum for boys. Now, that's a decade ago. Things are starting to change. But David, you know, why is it so important that we include doing things for men and boys if we're going to have a way forward? And why do you think it's so, Ben, society has been slow to see, you know, that we had to work on that as well?
That's a really good and complex question. And I'll try not to be too reductionist in my response. I think that there was a very necessary focus on women and children over the many previous decades and one or two generations. It was essential. And I think that what we're realizing, however, that the health and well-being of women and families, whatever definition you use to define a family, means that until we include men and boys in the equation of the health and well-being of families, the health and well-being of families is compromised. And so that the change we need to see is that we continue to believe that we should enhance integrity and well-being of families of women and begin to include men in a very honest way as we move into the future. because the negative effect and negative behaviors of men is affecting women and children and societies, and it's also affecting themselves. So that until we begin to look at how are all of the features of society affecting those men, nothing will change. We may have reached a plateau. We may have reached, I mean, there's still tons to do. I don't want to be simplistic about this at all. There's tons to do with regard to diversity and inclusion. We're not nearly there yet. However, if we don't also ask some tough questions about the health and well-being of men, the progress on the other domain will be limited. And less so if we can begin to talk about how the way we function hurts us and hurts others. And we know that hurt people, and we know that if the hurt isn't transformed, it'll be transmitted. And that's what's been going on. So we need to change the equation with all due respect and no compromise in the care that we provide for women and children. But somehow we need to begin to bring the health and well-being of men into that equation. If we really want optimal change, it'll never be perfect, but we need to move toward an optimal change.
And I understand that the major focus of your work right now is on fatherhood. And why is fatherhood important, and what has to happen for fatherhood itself to be reimagined? Matthew Fox, in his book on the hidden spirituality of man, lists a number of factors, including the fact that many men are still very busy with their work and haven't been trained in that way to be fathers and in the way they can be. And, you know, two examples that come to mind is both Putin and Trump, who had very difficult relationships with their fathers.
That's right. And you know, part of my investment and desire to begin Blueprint also came from a World Congress of Women in 1995, where women were asking men to be involved in some way so that they would stop the violence and begin to contribute to families and communities in a more positive way. And you know, for my interest in this does go back to my own relationship with my father because of his bipolarity. So it's not it hasn't escaped me that there's a very deep personal interest in this work, the absence of fathers at the bedside of their sons who were gay but dying. And you know, the most common question I get asked by military, fire, police, after these men have addressed their trauma and their grief, the most common question is, can you help me be a good dad? Because there's inherent in us is we do want to be honorable in not only in our communities, but we want to be honorable with our children. And so that's why I decided that, you know, rather than just looking at the literature or having my own ideas of what it might be, I'm going to work at asking up to 100 people who had a positive relationship with their fathers. How did that come about and what did it entail? Because the influence of fathers, whether you're present or absent, whether you're a positive, have a positive effect or a hurtful effect, is lifelong. It will last with the children of that father forever. Yeah. And there's again new literature emerging that with regard to how people perform in the workplace, how they perform outside of the family and inside of the family, actually may be the father may have a more, this won't be popular with everybody, may have a more a stronger positive effect if it's there than with the mother. And here's a detail that what I learned is a 16-year-old girl who is very aware that her father is fully present and has her back will be healthier at 33. Mm-hmm. She'll have less anxiety. She'll be more content with life and be better able to perform in terms of her full capacity. So I think we're only beginning to understand the significance of a father or a father figure. It can be another male, but the presence of a man in a child's life is huge. And it's a demonstration of love and affection and purpose, right? And it teaches courage. It can guide kids in terms of what it means to be out in the world in a honorable way. Did that answer your question?
Yes. And if I may just add another dimension to it, I have been studying with Thomas Hubel, who looks not just at individual trauma, but ancestral trauma and collective trauma.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether the fatherhood issue is also complicated by the fact that we have inherited unwillingly and unconsciously some of the things that were true in our fathers and forefathers. Have you looked into that?
There is some evidence, but it's not as strong as we would hope. But that has to do with the epigenetics of our environments. And yes, they're looking at the grandchild of the grandparent actually may manifest features of trauma that are more like the grandparent than the parent. But I mean, that's stuff that's just emerging. But I'll tell you the story of one of the people I interviewed, because one of the questions in the interview is, can you tell me, tell me about your father, and can you tell me about your grandfather's relationship with your father? Because we're trying to identify trends. Yes. And the woman paused and said, I wish you could meet my grandfather, my great-grandfather. I said, oh, really? Why is that? She said, because he was treated horribly. He was abused. It was poverty. It was a horrible environment. But my great-grandfather decided that he would not perpetrate all of what he'd experienced, and that he would be a man that loved his children. And she said, and from that generation forward, the men have all been great fathers. So that's part of the evidence we're looking for, is what are the stories of people? Because we know from indigenous values that it may take seven generations for something to change. So here she's talking about four generations and it's still present. So that's just one anecdote, and it'll be more anecdotal than totally comprehensive. But that is the purpose, is to, can we get men to put their backs to all of the suffering they experienced and the abuse, and look forward to perpetrate features of love, compassion, protection against violence, protection against abuse. We don't need to protect against saber-toothed tigers. We need to protect against abuse.
Yeah. Right. And of course, trauma can only be healed if it's examined.
That's right.
And it takes courage to look at this by itself.
And, you know, John, I'll let you finish and then I'll respond to that. That is what we see with the firefighters. There is a blueprint. But when we work with firefighters in groups of eight, and we make it very, very, very safe.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many have talked about their childhood suffering, how people have talked about early sexual abuse for the first time in a group of men. Yeah. Where that the blueprint is, create the space of safety so men can begin to speak about the anguish of their souls, and then have other men respond in an empathic way. And hopefully also with some compassion, so that we do have a blueprint for that population in terms of the suffering they may have experienced. Sorry, John.
No, it's okay. Great conversation. I was thinking, I want to pause though on something, a story you said that was brief, but to me so profound, about that grandfather. You know, the Bible says the sins of the father are visited on the son. And I can imagine today there might be a father, a man listening to this podcast, who was given a sword, so to speak, by their own father. And maybe it went back several generations. And I just want them to see and hear, you have the power to stop it. And it isn't easy. You may have to be accountable to people. You may have to go to therapy, right? You may have to reach out and ask for help. You won't succeed every time you try. But I think it's a very profound story. We don't have to be victim to the sins of the father. I mean, I had my own experience with my father, right? In some ways, I replicated the sins of my father, but in other ways, I stopped it. And it's a very conscious decision, right? And I just think it's a really important thing to pause on, because so many times we can feel we're a victim to our genetics or a victim to our upbringing. And we are to some extent, but we can always be the one to stop it. And I just think it's just an important thing to just make sure people heard that, if you're one of those men who says, I want to stop it, and you can.
And I think Alain's talked about that in terms of pausing to reflect. And I think that that's what's really important, is to pay attention and then change your intention. And the attention we need to pay is to what impact did my father have on me? Good, bad, or ugly. So that because we are carrying forward, the evidence is such that the relationship with the father figure will be with you for your life. So that we know that, then we need to ask with detailed attention, what impact did that have on me? I think we need to ask the same about our mothers, but we're focusing on fathers here. So what, and then say, now is the time for change. And I've got a little piece of wood that I wrote on at my desk. If I don't change, I won't change. And so that the intention must be to change, because, you know, we default to the familiar. And Reeves, who just wrote an excellent book about fathers and son, says we're actually imprisoned. We're held prisoner by the familiar. We're so locked into the familiar. So we have to pay attention, and then in our attention, and then have the intention to move forward differently and to be willing to change, to move from the familiar to the unfamiliar.
You know, earlier you were talking about getting in the work you do with firefighters, and I know you also do work with athletes and business folks. But talk a bit about I think the myth about men is men don't want to talk. You know, men don't want to talk about these kind of things, right? There may be some truth to it, but tell us about your experiences about, you know, how do we get men talking, and what happens? You know, maybe you have a story or two. What happens when men finally talk about some of these things?
When men talk, they're set free. And so when we work with groups of men feel a lot of shame. Yeah. And shame holds us hostage. And shame means that I look away, I look down, I don't want to look inward because the shame feels so ugly. So when we work with groups of men, the very first, up after the introductions and all the work we do to create a safe space, the first question we ask them is to divide into pairs and to tell the other, their partner, about a moment in their lives that they're proud of. And it's often sad when men initially say, I don't have any, because we make it tougher on them and say, and you can't talk about the pride you have in your children. That's too easy. You have to talk about something that you're proud of about yourself. And then we send them away for 20 to 30 minutes to have this intimate conversation with somebody they've never met before. And sometimes that's easier. Yeah. And what we've learned is when we get them to come back to the group and talk, they have to introduce each other in terms of this moment of pride. And it doesn't matter what it is. Sometimes they're huge and sometimes they're small. And it changes men because they realize there's no shame in the room in that moment. And then we move from that to the hurt they might have experienced even before they became firefighters, and the hurt they might have experienced after. And so that men, when they begin to talk, and we get them to write it out first so that they actually are, because that it's proven to be of benefit, but they begin to know their story. And often the unconscious brings things into their fingertips that they didn't have in their thinking. So as they write, they'll say something came up that I haven't thought about for years. And we'll just encourage them to keep writing. So that, and then after that's finished, everybody else in the room must respond to finish the sentence, the impact your story had on me is. And we tell them, you can't fix them, you can't praise them, you can't scold them, you can't give them advice. This is about your own inner journey, about the impact your story has on me. And we work on getting them to express it, because often they have a big trouble trying to respond in an empathic way. And out of that often is the beginning of healing, because the word for healing is the same as the word for whole. And wholeness includes all of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so they stop avoiding it and they go into their pain and their trauma and their previous experiences. So it is, men do talk, but it has to be very safe. We absolutely tell them it's confidential. We don't even greet them on the street until they greet us in terms of confidentiality, because the person they're with might ask who that is, and we don't ever disclose anything about that. So it has to be safe, and it has to be honest. and we can't be seen as the professionals who know everything. We also have to disclose about our own lives and our own experiences that may be have shame affiliated or associated with our experiences. So we're no different from them. We just have a different skill set. They don't want us in a fire, and we wouldn't want them leading this, but we want them participating. That's a very long answer to your question.
Matthew Fox, in his book, in one of his books on masculinity, talks about toxic masculinity and sacred masculinity. I don't know whether these words have any resonance for you, but I was intrigued that how do we shift other than creating these safe spaces for people to recognize that they have something beautiful to offer in them because of their masculinity. Is that something that comes up in the conversations you have?
It does. Before I answer that, though, I'd be interested to hear. I have my own. I understand toxic masculinity. I have my own sense of sacred masculinity. I'd be interested to learn from you. What does Matthew Fox say about sacred masculinity? That's a great term. We often talk about aspirational masculinity, but Nobody's talked about sacred masculinity. I think the space we create for firefighters is sacred. Yeah. But I'd be interested. What does Matthew Fox say about it?
Yeah, he has a fairly wide definition of what is sacred. It's something that is precious, valuable, that is honored because it is something that we deeply need, that connection to our deep aspirations, and not just for ourselves, but also for other people. So that sense of if I change, I also have an effect on others that will be beneficial. That's at least my interpretation of what he says.
I really like that. And again, going back to the work with the firefighters, it's actually we have the privilege of witnessing exactly what you describe. So they are very aware. And we've had groups of male and female firefighters where the female firefighters actually spoke about how they had been abused and sexually harassed by male firefighters. And as they were talking, the male firefighters started crying. Right. And then they had to respond. The impact your story has on me is. And they were sad. They were angry. They were annoyed. They were ashamed. They were embarrassed because of their colleagues had treated these women so poorly. So those are all features of toxic masculinity, of that the need to dominate, the need to be anti-feminine, anything that is soft or crying. And female firefighters actually would say, they would say this to me, we have to be more male than the male firefighters, because if we cry, it's really over. If men cry, they might just be dismissed as being soft or girl-like or what, but we would be totally dismissed and all of our credibility would be in question, even whether we were effective firefighters. And however, as they begin to soften and to tell their stories and to go into their truth of the pain they've experienced for being toxic, for not asking for help, for not shedding a tear because of what they saw at a particular call. As they go into the softness, they begin to say, and we also include some communication skills and understanding of complexity of relationship. They often move once they've shifted inside themselves and in their own inner journey. They begin to say, this is going to affect how I relate to my partner, to my wife. And then they'll say, and well, how could this be different for my kids? Right. So it goes into a very sacred place within 4 days.
Yes.
I got an email. I'll try to be quick. I got an email from a firefighter who said, how can I love my kids? And I said, first of all, you got to tell them you love them. You're proud of them. And you wouldn't want to live your life without them in it. Then you got to hug them. And if they play, you got to play what they play and where they play. 24 hours later, I got an email from the guy and he said, I have 3 sons and you were so right. I came home and I got on the floor. Imagine this. My son's 12 years old. I came home and I played on the floor with him for the first time. And then I decided to hug my sons and you told me to hug them until they let go, not when I let go. And he said, you were so right there again. One hugged me for 2 seconds, one's for 5 seconds and one for 2 minutes. So it's all of that softness that once we can go into our own need for healing, we can then also share that with others. And that becomes the desire, right?
Yeah. So that's the place of the heart.
Yes.
And to some extent, the body also.
That's right.
Using the body as a sensory organ that can help us relate to others in a different way.
That's right. But it has to start with self.
Indeed.
I was thinking too, David, that one of the things we know from the research is that men perceive other men to react more negatively to their expression of vulnerability than other men actually react. So that one of the myths that men go around with is, if I'm vulnerable, if I act, show my soft underbelly, the hurt part of me, that other men will think less of me. But what you have is all these men running around thinking that, but at some level wanting to show that underbelly, right? And we have to somehow help men see that. It turns out in our research on the Me Too movement that men also tend to see other men as more misogynistic than they are. So again, I don't speak up because I think, well, other men really like that joke. I'm the only man who thinks this way. And you have lots of men running around with those thoughts and their related concepts, right? And that's that culture of bullying and competition that is so powerful among boys, the Lord of the Flies thing, right? That boys are always trying not to be shamed. And take this shooter, the nightclub shooter in Colorado. I just found out that he'd been bullied online for months mercilessly about all kinds of things. And imagine that anger building up doesn't justify, of course, anything that he did. He had a choice, like that grandfather. But that's where the hurt file finally boiled out. And imagine if he could have been vulnerable on that hurt.
Right.
You know, I don't know his story, but I imagine it was all bundled up inside and came out in anger, as it almost.
And I think it starts with loneliness, because I can't admit to what's really going on inside of myself, because that would be shameful and I'd be seen as less than a man. So it moves from loneliness to isolation. And so now I'm in rumination of thinking that what my thoughts are actually true and they're a new reality. So that in all of that, not only does he become violent toward others, the reason we got involved with the firefighters is because of the suicides, the firefighters that weren't asking for help, but they were taking their own lives. So it is a very serious, and as I've said many times, it's a public health issue, that it's not just hurting individuals because they take their own lives, but before they were doing that, they were isolated in their communities and in their families, and that wasn't helpful for their families either. And it was, thankfully, the impetus for the Firefighter Association to say, we got to do something different to help these men. And they would now say that the work there has contributed to changing the culture. And that's only very one small group, but it's what needs to happen, you know. And again, you know, I just want to, I made mention of the author Reeves. He's written a great book of boys and men. I mean, it's somewhat academic, but he really says, his theme is that systemically we need to look at this differently. We need to look honestly at what approach can we take to change how men behave, not just as individuals but in society. So I just wanted to make reference. I named him, but I also wanted to give the title of his book.
And David, we have to get to boys and young men really early, don't we? I know you guys are involved in some work with boys and girls clubs and schools and young athletes. How important is it that we get to the young boys? I think of Sean Askenosi, my friend in Colorado, saying to the UN, we need something in the schools, which eventually he did, by the way. And they said, well, we don't know anyone who's done it, but that's changing now. So talk to us about what you're seeing is starting to happen with young men, and what do we need to do even more so with young boys and men to help them have these rites of passage, if you will, earlier?
Right. I think, as you alluded to earlier, that boys before 11 or some number 10 to 12 somewhere have as many friends as girls do. And at young age, they're expressing all of their emotions. So I think therein lies a clue to why it's important to meet boys at an earlier age in terms of, can we give them another message rather than saying, don't ask for help, don't express emotions, don't appear weak. I am working with a teacher in a elementary school, and I asked him about age, and he said, you know, by the time boys are in grade 9, which would be probably 11, 12, 13, it's too late, because their attitudes towards women are beginning to form, and it's often not in a positive way. We need to get to them in grade 6 and 7 mm-hmm. and 8, because as they get into those older grades, they're already moving toward negative relationships and understandings of what meaningful relationships are. So I think that the people that work in those areas really are asking for help with the younger grades, and how do we do that? And in an ideal world, it would start in kindergarten in terms of values of relationship that are respectful.
And, you know, I was thinking, David, you and I had the privilege of working with athletes at the West Point Military Academy at Army football, and also at the 3-time champion men's soccer team at Stanford. And I was thinking about one of the questions that we asked in that program is we asked young men to write down what they want to be known for. What kind of a man, a person do they want to be known for? And I know you both and I were struck by a young man at Stanford who said, no one has ever asked me to write this down. Mm-hmm. And something changed for me when I named, in Matthew Fox's term, what it would mean for me to be a sacred man. And so I think just having people ask that question at a much earlier age, how do you want to show up on every team you're on in your life, right? Because so many of us live an accidental life. And again, I always think the boys, often because of their relationships with fathers, are just kind of sent out, go play outside. We'll see you at dinner time, right? And we wonder why they get socialized by each other. David, I have a personal question for you. A whole theme of our podcast is about regeneration and the way forward. And we usually ask people, how do you try to live a more regenerative life? But I'm going to twist it a little bit for you. How do you try to be a more regenerative man and human being in this time? So what do you think personally for you? How do you try to be a more regenerative person, a more regenerative man?
It's attention and intention. It's no different than what I invite other men to do, to be very aware that I too am a prisoner to the familiar. And the familiar isn't just what I had in my home, but it was where was society at as I was growing up in terms of the messages it was giving me. Because you're asking me the question. And they were very similar to all of those. Don't cry, don't ask for help, be strong, be independent. And all the more was reinforced because I saw I saw mental illness as a weakness in terms of my dad. I had to process that and understand that. So that I also have to be aware, I want to live a life of integrity. I want to be true to all of my emotions. I want to be sad when I'm sad. I want to be excited. I want to be content. I want all of those things in my life, but I too default to the familiar. So can I be honest about who I am and what I'm experiencing? And can I be honest to, it just happened yesterday, we had our car repaired, and I remembered the fellow who was the man who was communicating the need, the car, the repairs that needed. I remembered about 2 years ago, I was rude to him because I was annoyed. It was a bad day. And I thought, if I'm going to be true to myself, I need to say, sorry. And I've been there since that, but I never saw him again. So yesterday, when I picked up the car, I said, after I'd paid my bill, done it all, I said, I need to say something to you. 2 years ago or so, I treated you really badly. I was rude to you, and I'm sorry. So what does that mean? It means I have to be constantly pay attention, and then with an intention to translate my intention to action. Whether that's in the workplace, whether it's right now, or whether it's with the mechanic who fixed my car. And that is my reminder to myself to invite myself to change. And if I don't change, I won't change. And I want to be a beacon of invitation in inviting men to live a life of love and compassion and honor and bravery. All those things still also hold true.
Beautiful. Thank you.
So our time, David, is almost up. I want to, first of all, thank you. And if people want to reach out to you, they can go to blueprint.ngo. That's blueprint.ngo. Find out about David's work. And again, truth in advertising, so to speak. I'm one of the co-founders, so you'll find me there as well. David, if there was one message you would give to men and one message you would give to society about men in like one sentence each. First of all, one message for men. Men listening today, what's the one message you would want them to hear?
Wow. You got me by surprise. I'm not often short of words. Right now, off the top of my head, it would be love yourself so you can love others.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah.
And have the courage to do both.
Fantastic. And David, one message for society about men and boys.
For society is to recognize that we're all, many of us, most of us are imprisoned to the familiar. And we need the key to open the door, to move from the familiar, which is devastating, to a life of wholeness and integrity, which is a life that's healed. And for society, begin to realize that this is longer than a sentence, invite men to live a life of love, recognizing that doesn't compromise who they are as men with regard to valor, bravery, honor, and courage, because a life of love requires all of those ingredients as well.
Beautiful. Alon, closing comment from you, then I'll close us out.
I'm very inspired by what you said, and so grateful that you would spend this time with us, and all blessings on the work that you do with so many others.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be here.
Thank you. So I want to say amen to that. Thank you, David. Thank you, Jim, our wonderful producer, and Alon. And most of all, thank you, who have given your time to listen to our podcast today. Please, if you like what you heard today, like it and share it. If you liked it but thought it could be better, send us a message. If you've got a guest or a topic that you'd love us to explore, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to interact. And again, I think we began today talking about all the things going on in the world right now. And we talked about the hopeful possibility that men and boys can come into this conversation in a new way, beginning with themselves, and then the impact they have on the world. So thank you very much. And again, we look forward to seeing you again. I'm John Izzo. Have a good day.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Elders Action Network and Blueprint NGO. Elders Action Network is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Blueprint is catalyzing a global conversation about the state and impact of men in the world. Together, they are mobilizing men to be a force for good. Their website is blueprint.ngo. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation Podcast, which you can listen to on Podbean and Apple Podcasts.